This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kind of overwhelming, isn't it, the number of stories in the news about conspiracies and scandalous covert operations? There's the BCCI international banking conspiracy, new investigations into the October surprise, and renewed interest in the Iran-Contra affair now that a former CIA official has confessed that he withheld information from Congress under orders from his superiors. Seems like an interesting time to talk to a former director of Central Intelligence. My guest is Admiral Stansfield Turner, who served as CIA chief in the Carter administration. When Turner took over in 1977, Congress had just completed an investigation into past excesses within the CIA. He tried to reform the agency's image. For 444 days, he worked for the release of Americans held hostage by Iran. His new book, Terrorism and Democracy, is about how American presidents have dealt with terrorists. The American hostages were released shortly after President Reagan was sworn into office. I asked Turner if he believes there was a so-called October surprise, that Reagan aides cut a deal with Iran to withhold the release of American hostages until after the election, in exchange for shipments of American arms to Iran.
I think it's unfair to jump to that conclusion, because the evidence is only circumstantial. In recent months, the amount of circumstantial evidence has been growing, however. We've reached the point where the nation needs to have this problem put to bed. I just cannot understand why the White House doesn't do that by adducing the necessary documentation to show where various people were at the times they are alleged by some to have been involved in making deals with the Iranians.
When you were the director of Central Intelligence during the hostage crisis, were you approached by the Iranians to make an arms for hostages deal?
No, I was not. We knew that two other campaigns were, that is, the campaign of John Anderson for president and the campaign of Ronald Reagan. We never had any inclination that a deal was being made, however.
Why do you think that they were approached and you weren't?
Well, there were constant discussions going on between us, that is, the administration and the Iranians, over these hostages. They never came to us and specifically said they wanted arms for the hostages, but we had frozen a whole lot of arms the Shah had paid for before Khomeini took office, and President Carter had made it clear when he froze those that they would be released when the hostages were returned. So the Iranians didn't need to make a bargain with us. They had an implicit understanding here that if they released the hostages, the arms would be delivered.
Was President Carter on the verge of negotiating any kind of release?
Yes, we were negotiating from almost day one. President Carter was leaning heavily on the negotiating option, particularly in December, January, February 79-80. We just couldn't find anyone in Iran who could make a deal with us. We had great debates over what would fit within the national honor, what would ensure that we really would get the hostages out if we made some kind of a deal, and what would not set an undue precedent for future hostage taking. We never could come to the right mix, nor could we find the people with enough authority inside Iran. Those negotiations resumed after the rescue operation in September of 1980, when it was the Iranians who came to us and said they wanted to work out a deal, and they wanted it to be consummated before the election of November 4th, 1980.
What kind of deal did they suggest?
They wanted to get the hostages returned to us. They wanted to get us to relinquish financial claims against them for the hostage situation. They wanted us to return money that we had frozen of theirs that was in our banks in this country and abroad. We worked very close, I think, to coming to some agreement there when one of two things happened. Either the Iranians, because they had dissension in their own ranks about the desirability of a deal, stumbled around and couldn't get their own act together until 2 days before the election, and then they made a proposal to us that was totally unacceptable, or the Reagan administration did make a deal behind the scenes, and the Iranians deliberately postponed coming to any conclusion with the Carter administration past Election Day.
And you're beginning to think that the latter really was a possibility.
You're putting words in my mouth.
I thought that's what you said earlier.
No, I did not say that. I very carefully avoided saying that. I said there is more circumstantial evidence today than there was a year ago. That means that I think we want to get an investigation of some sort that gets to the bottom of this, or preferably the necessary disclosures from the White House. I do not want to be associated with any accusation that there was an October surprise deal made by the Reagan administration. I think it's such a terrible thing to accuse anybody of that I don't want to do that on the basis of circumstantial evidence.
I stand corrected, thank you.
Surely.
For just joining us, my guest is Stansfield Turner, who was the director of Central Intelligence from 1977 to 81, and he's written a new book called Terrorism and Democracy. In your book, you say that presidents are always saying that they do not make deals with terrorists, but presidents sometimes really do make deals with terrorists. And you say that deals are an option we can't really rule out, but some deals are less objectionable than others. What are your standards about when it's appropriate to make a deal with terrorists and what kind of deal is appropriate?
First, you ask yourself, will this deal achieve what I want? Will it get my hostages back or whatever it may be? Sometimes you can't be sure of that. Secondly, what will it do to our national honor? Are we lowering ourselves here in the eyes of the entire world? And thirdly, will this give such a reward to the terrorists that it will actually incite them to do more terrorism? Is it so obvious to them that by taking some more hostages, they can get some more of whatever we gave them in this deal? So you have to weigh these three factors. A deal such as President Lyndon Johnson made, in which he signed a false confession saying that a U.S. Navy ship had intruded into North Korean waters, in order to get hostages out, was not a bad deal, because Johnson even stood up before the signing and said, I'm only signing this because I want to get the hostages out. A deal of arms for hostages, that kind of a deal has a lot of hazard, because we obviously have an almost infinite supply of weapons, and if they want more, they can go out and take hostages.
So elaborate for me on where you think the Iran-Contra arms for hostages deal would fit into your standards of what's an appropriate deal to make with terrorists.
I think that was not an appropriate deal because, first of all, it didn't pass my first test. That is, would it be effective? The Iranians didn't release hostages in all six of the deals we made for arms. They only released them on three of those occasions. And in between, they took three more hostages. So we weren't getting anything out of this. Secondly, it clearly violated our moral standing in the world, because at the very time we were making these deals behind the scenes, we were urging our allies not to sell arms to Iran. And thirdly, it didn't meet the other criterion, because the Iranians simply would take more hostages if they wanted more arms for us. It was just too obvious a deal.
Alan Fiers was chief of the CIA Central America Task Force from 84 to 88 during the Iran-Contra happenings. He recently pleaded guilty to charges of withholding information from Congress under orders from his superiors. How far do you think the trail of guilt will lead within the CIA?
Well, it's very difficult to tell, because Mr. Casey had a very unorthodox management arrangement. He didn't use a chain of command, it appears. He skipped around and dealt directly with people at various levels in the agency. So I don't know that we can tell by outside judgment as to how many people were implicated in this. Certainly, a lot more people were involved than have been either brought before the courts or brought before discipline within the CIA.
William Casey was your successor as the head of the CIA. How would you characterize his style of leadership?
Well, his style was one of swashbuckling and disregard for laws and rules, in my opinion, as is indicated by the fact that he was criticized by his own superior, Ronald Reagan, after the fact, When Ronald Reagan got out of the Iran-Contra affair, he made a new rule for CIA covert actions. He said they must be things of which this country would be proud if the people did know about them. Of course, they're done in secret, so the people don't know of them. But that new rule that the president put out was an implied criticism of Mr. Casey for having done covert actions on a different basis. He was also criticized by his confrere, the Secretary of State, Mr. Shultz, who in the Iran-Contra hearings testified that long before Iran-Contra broke, he had come not to trust much of the intelligence he was receiving, indicating he thought Mr. Casey was putting a spin on this, a political spin. And it doesn't make any difference whether Shultz is right or wrong in that accusation. If a Secretary of State doesn't trust the intelligence he's receiving, you and I are wasting millions and millions of dollars in producing that intelligence, which is not going to be used.
Whoever the next director of the CIA is, he'll have to steer the agency in a post-Cold War world. How do you think the CIA's function will need to be redefined?
Well, first of all, we will give less attention to the Soviet Union, and it's difficult for me to emphasize how much the Soviet Union has dominated intelligence over the last 46 years. Secondly, we will give less attention to military matters because of this decline of the Soviet military threat. That means we're going to have to look around and see if there are other challenges that this country needs to confront. And one, of course, we all recognize today is the economic challenge to our country.
What's the CIA's role in economic battles between countries? What do you see the CIA doing in that?
I think the CIA has the role here as it does in military intelligence. Find out what's going on in the rest of the world. Find out what other people's game plans are. How do we protect our interests against people who are doing economic warfare against us? A lot of countries have what are called mercantilist policies, where the government deliberately pushes its commerce, its industry in particular directions, like, let's say, selling a particular product overseas at a loss for a few years in order to gain a majority of the market share and then raise the price and dominate the market. We want to know if that kind of thing is going on. We don't want to get caught short as we did in the early 1970s, for instance, when the Soviets had a very bad grain harvest. But before they announced that to the world, they came out and they bought all of our grain that they could at cheap prices. And the price immediately skyrocketed once we found out that they had this bad harvest. Since then, the CIA has predicted the Soviet grain harvest better than the Soviets do, and we don't get caught out anymore. There are lots of ways like these that the CIA, our whole intelligence community, can contribute to the well-being of our commercial enterprises.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stansfield Turner, who was director of Central Intelligence from 1977 to 81. He's written a new book called Terrorism and Democracy. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Former CIA director Stansfield Turner is my guest. The CIA director William Webster has ordered a review of any CIA ties to the BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and this is the bank that was used by terrorists, dictators, arms merchants, and governments carrying out covert wars. Did you ever use the BCCI when you were head of the CIA?
I had no knowledge of the BCCI when I was head of the CIA.
When did you find out about the BCCI?
Well, a few weeks ago in the papers, or a few months ago.
You never knew about it until then?
Nope. That seems to leave you stunned. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, it does.
No, I did not have any knowledge of it while I was in the CIA.
Now, you said that you didn't know anything about the BCCI until recently, but could you help explain what kind of special banking needs there are when you're fighting a secret war that would lead everybody who's been using the BCCI to use it?
No, I'm not going to be able to explain to you the intricacies of funding agents overseas and such forth that the CIA does have to do, and I don't think that's an appropriate thing to discuss in public.
Robert Gates is President Bush's nominee to head the CIA. Now, he worked very closely with you. He was your executive assistant. And he worked very closely with your successor, William Casey. What kind of CIA director do you think Robert Gates would make?
Robert Gates is eminently qualified for the job by his background, by his close association with our president and his staff, and by the fact, incidentally, that he's a Soviet expert at a time when it's going to be necessary to lead the CIA away from as intense an interest in the Soviet Union as it's had for the past 46 years. On the other hand, Mr. Gates would come to the job, if he's confirmed, with an unfortunate cloud over his head of having been associated with Mr. Casey. And as long as that exists, he has a handicap there. So there are pluses and minuses for him, but only the Senate, in its wisdom, can determine whether those clouds that hang there because of the Casey regime outweigh the other strengths that Mr. Gates would bring to the job.
Now, Gates says he didn't know anything about the Iran-Contra deal, but do you find it credible that somebody as high up as he was within the CIA could not have known about it?
As we discussed earlier, Mr. Casey's style of management was so unique that I find it difficult to answer that question frankly. That is, I can't imagine under my tenure my deputy not knowing something as important as that went on. I felt it was my responsibility to keep him posted, even if he were not highly involved in a particular situation. But heavens, I could have died overnight, and he would have had to pick up the reins. But Mr. Casey's style was entirely different and rooted in a false sense of secrecy, in my opinion, and or greater sense of secrecy than necessary, I think would be a better way to put it. And he may have bypassed his deputy.
I'd like to know if you get personally angry when there's a scandal like this involving the CIA, as someone who formerly headed it.
Oh, I get very disappointed. When I left the CIA, I felt that we had established standards of ethics, standards of legality, that the people understood that, and yet I find that very quickly Mr. Casey was able to ferret out at least a handful of people who were willing to break the law, like lying to the Congress or carrying out covert actions without presidential authorization, and to work around the system, to fail to inform the Congress adequately. I find it very disturbing and very disappointing because it all happened so quickly. I take consolation now, however, that when Mr. Webster came in 1987, he's turned back the clock, and most of the reforms that we instituted in the Carter period have been reestablished now. It's unfortunate there was this derailment for 6 years, which has again cast a great shadow in the American public's mind over the CIA. I was on a college campus not too long ago and almost was shouted off when I went to make my scheduled speech. That's very disturbing to me in 1990, 1991. That should be behind us by now. The investigations of the CIA were back in 75, 76.
You've written a new book, Terrorism and Democracy. It's the second book you've written since you left the position of head of Central Intelligence. When you write a book, you have to submit it to the CIA, right?
Yes.
For CIA review, and they have the right to censor it. They have the right to tell you you can't reveal something.
Yes, let's be sure we understand the word censor, though. They're only supposed to take out things that are secret. They're not supposed to take out any criticism of the CIA or anything else like that.
Well, how has the review process worked for your two books? Have you been satisfied with the process?
Not at all. The first book, it was terrible. It was costly, took tremendous amounts of my time, and it ended up with removing material from the book that was totally unnecessary. I was not allowed, for instance, to quote one of my own speeches to an unclassified audience when I was in the CIA. One of the major things they wouldn't let me say in the book was that we use our satellites to take pictures in foreign countries. They said I could only admit we took pictures of objects associated with arms control agreements. 4 months after my book was published, the CIA made this same statement themselves in public, so it obviously wasn't very important to them. The second book when the administration had changed at the CIA.
The first book was under Casey.
Yes, from Casey to Webster, why everything went very smoothly.
How many things did they have you change in the second book?
Oh, I think there are only a couple of any significance in all, and I don't feel that it's deprived the book of anything substantial.
Now, wasn't it you that instituted the review process?
No, I was in long before my time. I was the first director to take someone to court to enforce the agreement. A man named Frank Snepp, after looking me in the eye and saying, "Yes, Mr. Director, I will submit my book for clearance to you," published it clandestinely and without coming to us for any clearance. Had we not done anything about Snepp and his book, the entire agreement would have been worthless from then on. So I went to the Attorney General and said, in order to uphold this agreement, which I think is a reasonable one, we ought to take Mr. Snepp to court, and we did.
What was the outcome?
He lost all of the profits from his book.
Did it set the precedent you wanted to set?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Did it feel different to be on the author end of the review process than it did on the CIA end of it?
Oh, yes. And lots of people say, well, Turner, you got hoist by your own petard. That isn't quite the case.
Actually, Frank Snepp said that.
He did?
Yes.
Well, you see, the difference is that I did submit my book. Snepp did not. I was hoist on the petard of a very unfair review process done under the Casey administration, where there was just this phobia about secrecy. And that abuse can take place with almost any regulation. This regulation itself is not inherently bad. I think it can be improved in several ways, but it's not something that we should dispense with. But it can be abused, and it was under Mr. Casey.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your doing it.
Former CIA Director Stansfield Turner. His new book is Terrorism and Democracy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.